Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. How many times do you think I've said that over the past 13 and a half years?
A few, I think. I don't think there's any question about that. One thing we do from time to time as well is we retrace our steps because we want to have the opportunity to bring you some of our best friends from the past programs. And this is one of those. And it's so wonderful to find these great, good people in the restaurant business.
Doing well,
being successful, being the same happy and smiling and intelligent people that we've met. And close to the top of the list, curiously enough, is an American.
I always forget that he's American, and a keen golfer, we might add, right?
Yes, exactly.
Kevin Donovan.
His name is Kevin Donovan.
Married to Gail, who's a divine, she's just absolutely a force of nature.
I think she popped into the interview a little bit, but I'm not absolutely sure.
She did, yes.
And then we're going to
Philippe Michel.
Michel, who's the king of French bistros in Australia and other parts of the world as well.
Yeah, he worked in Japan.
And finally, among the people who's been the most successful in probably will soon be the whole world in terms of the restaurants
that he controls and
influences, Neil Perry. So that's on the agenda for today's program. Let's get started with Kevin.
This feels like being in a very unusual position, listeners, because out in the field, I'm in front of the microphone as well as behind it. But there's a special reason for that, because Kevin Donovan to my right and Peter were the guys who cooked up this revisit after the last time I think we met was 9 years ago in 2008. We're returning to St. Kilda Beach to a newly remodeled, renovated Donovan's house. More about that later, but first of all, Kevin, welcome to On the Menu Radio once again.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's great to be with you, and it's great to have you with us here in Australia. I know that you're here for the world's 50 best restaurant announcement and the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, but Gail and I are very, very pleased that we've had the opportunity to renew our acquaintance. We've now been here for 22 years at Donovan's on St. Kilda Beach. This is our life's work, everything we dreamed of having, of being, of creating, of welcoming guests to our house on the beach.
Remind me, what was this originally a Bathers Pavilion kind of structure?
Yes, Peter, it was built in 1928 as a bathing pavilion, and back then, for a shilling, people would come in their finery, and when they put their shilling in the turnstile, they received a locker, a towel, and a shower. So they would change, swim out on St. Kilda Beach, come back, change back into their finery on a Sunday afternoon, and go out and have afternoon tea. And over the years, people's needs changed, and after World War II, life changed, and through the 50s and 60s, this building became a bit run down. So back in 1985, the Victorian State Government and Visit Victoria and the local municipality, the City of Port Phillip, decided to create a tourism destination, and in 1986, the first restaurant guys was called Jean-Jacques by the Sea. And Jean-Jacques was a French chef. And he and his wife, Susan, ran the restaurant for 9 years. And Gail and I were lucky enough to purchase the lease of this facility and we took over in January 95. And we're still here.
Now you've been through a difficult adventure. We'll come back to that one. But the most important an interesting thing that has gone on, and Gail's the person who's been behind that, is she loves to redecorate the interior with bottles of different genres. We've seen vermouth bottles. I think we've seen Heineken bottles. Today it's a spirit I don't even know about. But as part of refreshing the interior of the restaurant every 6 months, how and why do you do that?
two really good reasons that this this area, being this beautiful bay that we sit on, Port Phillip Bay, takes on a whole different meaning. Summer for her is hot and sexy and fun and vibrant, and so now you see it's all lime green and orange colours and linen. It's about having cocktails out watching the sunset. It's sensationally fun, rollerblading. It has that kind of feel to it. So I've tried to interpret that in the restaurant with these vibrant colours and things. However, when winter comes to Melbourne, she comes quite suddenly and quite harsh, although it doesn't snow or do anything like that, but it's windy and it's cold. And so when we built the restaurant, we put in two different fireplaces, so then she becomes coming. I call her a girl because she's a bit difficult sometimes. So she's always been a she. So for winter coming in now, you can see we've got vibrant orange and citrus and black and white stripes and lime green colours, and all the cushions outside are lime green and orange. And so, yeah, that's really cute and fun. And then in this winter coming in, she's going to be chocolate brown and royal navy blue wool.
If this were a TV, you could see Gail's eyes flashing with excitement. She just adores this. Gail, tell us, you're actually designing furniture now?
I decided that we needed new chairs for the lower part of the restaurant, and I'd looked at everything that was around, and there are loads of chairs that come from all over the place, but mostly out of China and Indonesia and mass-produced, and I wanted to see... I have a friend who does our upholstering, who inherited his dad's business, whose factory is next door to his friend who makes furniture, who inherited his dad's business. Oh, nice. They went to school together. So over a little glass of beer at the local Thai restaurant near the factory where their factories, we talked about being able to, could they possibly think together, could we make a chair if I could find something I like the look of. And so together I looked up some drawings and photographs and said, do we think, and after slow progress, it took us about 3 months to make 7 or 8 prototypes, then bring them back here to the restaurant and see if Kevin likes sitting in them. That was the next thing. Most important thing, does it fit under the table? Is it comfortable? And so we're the proud owners of 100 beautiful chairs that were made in Melbourne.
Now, this was all precipitated by this monster fire.
The monster fire, yes. We had a fire in the flue in the kitchen. Luckily, we don't do that anymore because the flue has water inside it, so it can't catch fire anymore. Things have changed since the restaurant was first built. Unfortunately, we did, and as this is an old building with a timber structure in the roof, and it was blowing a beautifully strong southerly wind, it was like putting a match to a barbecue, basically. It didn't take long. But look, everybody got out beautifully. All of our staff were, you know, standing outside with all the bookings book and the computer chips and all the things, and the guests were all safe and well, so nobody got hurt. So that was absolutely fine. And next day we of course, did more television interviews than we've ever done owning a restaurant. I could see somebody standing across the road just sort of looking. I said, who are you? And it was our friend Frank who built this restaurant for us initially. He said, I'm already here. I've got the temporary fencing coming. I've got everything coming. I'll work with the fire brigade. I'll work with the insurance people. We'll build up. So, and by that afternoon, of the day after the fire, we knew that our insurance was as good as we had thought it was. So we just set, Kevin and Frank set about rebuilding the construction, and I set about outside of here, because I actually couldn't look at it. I couldn't. So I just couldn't. I mean, there was still food in the pans in the kitchen. I felt it soul destroying. But what I did feel is that we had a restaurant that was almost 20 years old, and we would have been in a position where we needed to decide, okay, she needs a good refurbishment. Are we going to do that and carry on for the next, or what are we, you know, we were sort of, so our minds were made up for us, which was perfect because we managed to create something that it's has made us busier than we ever were. And all our beautiful Donovan's devotees flocked back to us the minute we opened the door. It was so, they were so loyal and honourable to us, and it's made the business terrific. So I think the thing is too that from a business perspective, in that I might shop all the time and everyone thinks that's fun and change the way the restaurant looks, but we've never advertised. So, and we've always worked on the theory that if someone tells you they've been somewhere that they loved, it's so much better than if you read it in the paper, in an ad. It's not going to make you go. So,
now, I had a tour of this wonderful new kitchen, and I wonder, with all this new equipment, what has changed by way of your cooking style or the menu?
And the cooking philosophy of the restaurant has always been produce-driven, and handling the produce in the best possible way, not masking it, not playing with it. But we have been able to add a few little whiz-bang things. We put a Josper charcoal oven in the kitchen to replace the open char grill we had. And this has allowed us to not get any burn on any of our seafood or steaks. But since it's cooked over charcoal, which comes to us from the Blue Mountains in New South Wales, it allows us to capture the flavor of the charcoal rather than the burn of flame over our products, which has been very, very important. We added induction cooking into the kitchen, which has an a la plancha, where we do fish to get nice crispy skin, and it's certainly decreased the temperature and the working environment in the kitchen from the old Target tops, which burn incessantly all day long and superheat a kitchen. A new canopy was designed specifically for the kitchen. We used to do some sous vide cooking, not a lot, but we've modified how we do that in a better fashion. But it's not a feature of the menu. We use certain products in the French method under vacuum. Things that don't have a lot of fat, which, for example, we're doing a beautiful duck breast cooked sous vide for 2 hours at 57 degrees. So it sets the proteins in the breast, and it's the finished product is sublime. We know that many Michelin three-star restaurants and top restaurants use a lot of sous vide cooking. We still like the sizzle of a pan. Cooking pasta to order, and then finishing it in the pan I always remember
what was her name?
Tutia Tavolo.
Lydia.
I always remember watching Lydia Bastianich on television, and how she deftly cooks pasta, making the sauce at the same time, and then tutti a tavola. That's how we want to cook and eat. We have a large menu. There's probably, if you count appetizers and main courses, we probably have 60 items on the menu. And when we reopened after the fire, we dedicated 10 menu items that have been staple items on the menu for many, many years, we've attached our logo, the little house, to each one of those menu items. So it's on the menu. Each of those 10 dishes, for example, we cure and cold smoke our own salmon. We do these wonderful barbecue prawns. We have a terrific seafood linguine with prawns and scallops from Tasmania and mussels here from Port Phillip Bay and Moreton Bay bugs. Our fish and chips is quite a signature dish. We were voted best fish and chips in Melbourne.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, which is good. You know, our colonial heritage suggests that we keep some things from Mother England, and obviously fish and chips being very, very important to the English. It's also very, very important in Australia. Our T-bone steak comes from Tasmania, grass-fed, comes from smaller beasts, so we get a good the good sirloin side and the eye fillet side. It's produce-driven, completely produce-driven, and cooked simply. We don't with this style of cookery, you cannot mask anything. Everything has to be perfectly cooked. A whole fish goes into the Josper, and it must be on the point when it comes out and gets to our guest. That much care. And we have 60 staff in the restaurant.
That's a lot.
Because we operate 364 and a half days a year. The only meal period we don't serve is Christmas dinner. We're open for Christmas lunch. We open for Christmas Eve, the Christmas lunch, and then we reopen on the 26th, which we call Boxing Day. And then we're open every other day of the year for lunch and dinner.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, we've known Philippe Bouchel for so long. I was still doing talk radio over the regular radio airwaves when we first met him. But 20, he's doing 20, well.
25 years ago.
And he's mentored so many wonderful chefs. Let's listen to our conversation. We're just sitting here with Philippe Bouchel trying to figure out how many years we have known each other. It has to be over 25.
25. It's exactly 25 years. 25 years in Australia and 25 years in Melbourne as well.
How many different restaurants have we had with you as our super chef? We start with
Paul Bocuse. First we start with the Paul Bocuse. And then I went to Langton. So I think it's five restaurants, actually. Five restaurants in 25 years. So one restaurant every 5 years. That's not bad. That's not bad.
Very good. And this one is called, I keep trying to remember to use that word, eponymous, but I never do. It's sort of stilted. But it's called Philippe, this restaurant, and it is much more straightforwardly a bistro, but new style bistro.
It's, you can call it a bistro, a French bistro, French techniques, but we try to use as much as possible as Australian produce, of course, local produce, raised beef in Gippsland in Victoria, same for the chicken, same for the lamb, pasture raised, you know. Also the fish will be from the bay, nothing imported, but, you know, cooked simply as well. I'm still using my rotisserie, I'm still using my charcoal oven, so very simply cooked, but tasty and good product.
Now, one change, I'm looking at the changes, is when we first met you, you had a strong Japanese influence, and that's not here anymore.
No, it's not, because I like to keep my cuisine moving. You know, I like to keep the customer interested as well, and my staff interested. And I think maybe as I get older, I like to go back to my roots, so this is why I'm cooking French now. But a more simple, a more light way of cooking French.
Now, what we were just, Peter and I were just talking about, well, there are a couple of chefs in the world in different cities, and you're one of them, where you take all the leading chefs in Melbourne and you look at their resumes, and every single one of them will have your name on it. How many people have you mentored, do you suppose?
Well, maybe not all of them, but some of them are doing actually very well. You know, people who work with me at Paul Bocuse, who work with me at Langton, at the Brasserie, and I keep teaching them all the time, you know, because this is what I like. I like to do. I like to cook. I'm always in the kitchen, but I like to teach my staff as well, so I don't have to work so hard.
Now, you were born and raised in Normandy?
Yes, that's correct. Born and raised in Normandy, and then I moved to Lyon, as you know, working with the famous Paul Bocuse.
Yes, and of course we mentioned that you worked a long time in Japan. Your wife is Japanese. You were highly influenced by Japanese cooking. How many years was that?
Oh, well, I worked for 13, 14 years in Japan, and, you know, I still love Japanese cooking, of course. I'm going there during Easter, so I can eat some more good sushi. But I like Japanese food. You know, when I'm at home, I only eat Japanese.
Well, you don't cook it there, right?
I don't cook it at all. You got it right there.
Two things slipped by that I wanted to just ask you about, just because they're of interest generally to people who are trying to understand Melbourne dining, or Sydney dining for that matter. So mention the names of some of those guys and gals who've come through your arms, embrace, and have gone on to be successful.
Yes, well, you have a young chef called Stuart Bell. Stuart Bell was one of my sous chefs, and he's now working in the Mornington Peninsula in a winery called 10 Minutes by Tractor, and they also do very very good wine, and they have a restaurant which is a two hat on a good food guide in Melbourne. So this is one of them. We have also Joe Varghetto, which is, Joe is doing Italian food. He's got three restaurants. I have also, I mean, there's so many. Sasha Randall as well was one of my sous chefs, and she's also doing very well. I mean, there is too many. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting them, but there's a lot. And, you know, and they always come back, and we keep in touch all the time. We keep in touch all the time. So, you know, it's good. I really enjoy cooking, teaching them, and they give it back to me, you know.
You know, you French chefs, you, you keep in touch with each other all over the globe. I ask you, do you know so-and-so in London? Yeah, you know all of them. What is it, an informal network, or what do you do?
I don't know all of them, but I believe as a chef you have to stay informed what's happening with the rest of the world, you know. And now it's so easy with social media, with internet, with magazine, and you know. And when I go overseas, when I go to Paris, when I go to New York, I know where to go. I know where to eat. And I think it's important. You know, you cannot stay only in your restaurant, in your kitchen, believing what you do is the best food in the world. You have to go outside, because everyone is pushing hard. The young chef is pushing hard. So I like to be informed. About cuisine, nouvelle cuisine, new recipes, but also new techniques and new equipment as well, which I think is very important.
Tell me, surprise me, about some of this current contemporary technique and cookery that has sort of, you've absorbed, especially equipment. What are you using that's different from what you used to use before?
my equipment is very easy because, like I said earlier, as you know, getting older, I like to cook very simply. I'm still doing all my cooking in a rotisserie like I used to have, chicken, lamb, duck. So it's a very easy, natural way. Not easy, but natural way to cook. All our meat and fish is also cooked in a charcoal oven. So my two pieces of equipment now is a rotisserie and a charcoal oven. That's all I have. I don't cook sous vide. I know people like sous vide, but I don't use it.
Talk to me about your chickens. I looked at those chickens. They're gorgeous.
Well,
they're from near Geelong.
Yeah, they are from Geelong, Bannockburn. You're absolutely right. Again, it's a good chicken. First, you have to have a good product. You can have a rotisserie. If you have a bad quality chicken, you will end up with a bad quality dish, of course. Everything needs to be good. And so at the moment we're cooking our chicken with a fast of mushroom under the skin. And it's a little bit different than how we used to do it. We only cook the breast and the leg are confit and grill after. So on the plate you have the breast and you have the leg as well. They're not cooked together because sometimes when the leg is cooked, the breast can be overcooked, so we try to find the right balance.
What other dishes that should I pay attention to on your current menu?
The chicken. we have a lot of dishes. We have some very good charcoal grilled beef. We have the chicken is here. The barramundi. Well, and the barramundi at the moment are wild barramundi. I will not use farm barramundi, but wild barramundi is different. Okay, so no barramundi. Yeah, I know. The one I had today was quite good. Yeah, exactly.
No, Peter was talking about we tried the farmed barramundi and it wasn't the same. No. We like what you taught, yes.
Yes. You're absolutely right. The farm barramundi tastes like mud. You know, they live in mud, they taste like mud. The wild barramundi, they line coat. This one is from Omdidu in Northern Territory. And they poached, very slowly poached, served with some tagliatelle, and we do like a bouillabaisse fumée. You know, very tasty, very good. We have the lamb, of course, from Flinders Island. I reckon it's the best lamb in Australia. At the moment, on the last menu was rack of lamb, but now it's lamb shoulder. The beef is good. We have the Wagyu as well. We have a tenderloin. All raised, pasture raised, no grain fed, pasture raised. And then on the entree selection, we have the salmon. We have the pâté en croûte, which is quite... pâté en croûte is a specialty from Lyon, as you know. And we have snail. We have a lot of things.
Now, you have a raw bar, and we've noticed oysters are outrageously expensive, and our cousin in Devonport, who we just visited, was telling us that there's some kind of a disease in the supply of shores. Is that why?
Yes. They're expensive, like you say, because, I mean, oysters, good oysters are always expensive because they took time to raise, you know. It's a lot of work, a lot of handling, a lot of wage cost as well. And the problem we have in Australia, we have a high cost of transportation as well, you know, because they can't come from Queensland, from Tasmania. So it's far away, so the cost is quite high. And we have good oysters. We have good oysters, and this is what I decide to have a raw bar here. It starts like in America or even in France. You have a lot of kind of oysters. Like I went in January in a bar in New York called Maison Première, and they had about 20 kind of oysters, which we don't have here. Yeah, and they were good actually. But I love oysters. I love oysters.
Yeah, and Peter said he thinks the Eau Claire is all right. Well, now, we are in Melbourne. Perhaps I guess we missed the place anyhow, but particularly because we're covering the World's 50 Best Restaurant Awards and the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival. Okay, so oysters, we're marking that down. We're going to try the oysters. I was asking you, though, about... it's amazing to have this activity in Melbourne all at one time. How is it being received by local chefs? Is everybody excited about having the 50 best here? And the, you know, it's controversial, I know that, but and also the I loved the Food and Wine Festival last time we were here. Tell us, is there excitement around these events right now?
Every chef in Melbourne waits for the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival every year, because there is a lot of chefs coming, international chefs, but this year it's even special because, like you said, of the 50 best. So we all hope that the chef stars will visit us, you know. I mean, we will visit them, of course, go to some meeting and so on and so. But yeah, it's, you know, in Melbourne, you know, who will predict that the San Pellegrino, the 50 best chef, or some of them will be in Melbourne 20 years ago. But now, you know, now with the quality of the food in Australia, not only in Melbourne, but everywhere in Australia, there is some very, very talented chef. And for the first time, two of Australian chefs will be in the 50 best. And both of them are from Melbourne. One is Benchery from Attica, and the other one is Dan Hunter. From Dan Hunter is in a country, in a small village called Bray.
Is he the one with Royal Mail?
He used to be at the Royal Mail. Yeah. So they will be. So you know.
You're projecting this. You don't know.
No, I'm sure they are. I can. Yeah, you know, I can tell you that they are. We're all very excited, of course. And, yeah, it's good. I think it's good for Australia. It's good for Australia. You know, and why is that happening? Because now we have good product as well, good ingredient to work with, good wine, you know. So the quality of the cuisine is getting better and better all the time.
Well, I'll tell you, certainly an improvement from when we lived here. That goes back a ways. Well, I expect, Philippe, that we will run into you over the course of the next 10 days or whatever it is that we're here. And it's wonderful seeing you again. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. It's good to see you once again. Thank you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
It turns out, not surprisingly, I guess, then again, it's always a surprise when things happen halfway around the world. But our final guest for today's program, Neil Perry, he's good friends with a well-known New York restaurateur called Danny Meyer. Apparently, they're good friends and their careers are on somewhat similar tracks, although Neil's a chef and Danny isn't. But other than that, they're both in the process of building restaurant empires and wanting, as Danny once told us, to make sure they have a restaurant that is available so that you can dine at a Danny Meyer restaurant any day of the week.
Right.
And
Neil Perry's doing the same thing. But he should have a title like the father of Mardaw's cuisine or something like that. I mean, we first encountered him in Sydney, right?
In Sydney, and it was in the 1980s.
Yeah,
when he had just opened a restaurant called Rockpool.
Right.
And we've met him a number of times since then.
Legendary as a chef in Australia.
Back in 2008, he had just opened Rockpool Steak and Seafood.
Yeah,
he was entering animal protein for the first time, And we caught up with him again because we wanted to have a wonderful lunch and talk to a very interesting and charming fellow, but we were also wanted to find out about recent developments where, as you'll hear, in our interview, it turns out he has not just one chain, but or two chains, or three chains, or four chains of restaurants, but probably five, and as a result of a recent merger between his operations and those of another major restaurateur in Australia. So, anyway, back to the introduction we gave.
He knows what he's doing. He's a good manager. His food is wonderful. He makes the right decisions. What else can you say?
You can say, just like Danny Meyer, that he's Neil Perry's proof that nice guys finish first.
Yes. Well, we're at Rockpool, Melbourne, and boy, this takes me back a long time, Neil Perry, to when we first saw you and met you in Sydney, because you're a Sydney guy. For the record, how long have you been at this chefing restaurateur business?
Well, I started in 1975, so it's almost too long to remember. But I think I've only managed to persist because of the longevity. And when people say to me, oh, you know, you're players or you're one of the most important people, you know, I kind of think that of the past. I think I've just been around for so long that I've kind of worn everybody down.
But you're always fresh. And there are a number of firsts, of course. When we went to Rockpool in Sydney, we encountered the long list of suppliers, which people weren't really doing that much then. But you've always been fixated on ingredients and suppliers.
Yeah, look, my father really taught me everything about seasonality. So he was a butcher, a fisherman, and a gardener, and so we would be digging things out of the garden bed in winter, or picking zucchinis and pumpkin and tomatoes off the vine in summer. And every fish that I ate as a youngster, we'd catch and fill it in the salt water and go straight into the pan, and some incredible meat. So that's always been the absolute focus of my. To me, I always want the ingredients to express itself, and I want to try and get myself out of the way of that. And so for me, simplicity has always been key. I've always tried to take the ego out of cooking and make it all about the ingredients. And I've also tried to make the whole philosophy of the restaurant, which is about care, making sure that the ingredient part of that, the care about that, was about the people who cared so much to bring us great ingredients. Because if I were to take a chicken, for instance, it probably takes 10 times more effort, energy, and commitment to grow a beautiful organic chicken, and they might get twice the price. So there's no economic rationale in that. It's really about passionate people who love what they do and allow me to have a chicken that can go around the rotisserie and be licked by fire and cooked in what I believe is probably the greatest method still known to man. That was the first one, chicken cooked by fire. And I have always felt that I had to express my gratitude by allowing people to know not only where did that product come from, but who as a company or as a person, those people who went to those extraordinary lengths, from and who they are.
It must have been very lonely, because we were here in 1975. It must have been very lonely for you in the restaurant industry in that year, with the focuses that you had, or the foci. I can remember what the plural focus is.
Yeah, absolutely. I started my life at front of house, which was really interesting. So I spent the first 5 years managing restaurants and or working as a waiter and a barman and then assistant manager and manager. One of the great things about that is I worked in a seafood restaurant where, because I knew so much about fish because of my dad, I was the person who went to the Sydney fish markets and bought the fish for the restaurant. And I also bought the wine and did wine tastings. And the incredible thing about that back in those days in the 70s was the Australian dollar was about 8 francs to the Australian dollar, which was a great exchange rate, and there was no import duties. So we were buying bottles of Krug for about, I think they were landing for, you know, $12, $14 in those days. We were buying first growth Bordeaux that were landing for, you know, $50, $60, $70. It was an incredible time. And I feel so fortunate because I learned so much about wine and I learned so much about service and being a restaurateur that I am now through that experience of being front of house. But most importantly, I also learnt that you don't necessarily need to lose it at people in the kitchen, or you don't necessarily need to be a hard taskmaster to actually get the best out of people. You can grow people and mentor them and work together for one common goal, and that's to do the best we can each day and tomorrow do better. And I honestly believe that that single-minded focus that I've had my whole career has allowed me to be 60 now and be still kind of at the forefront of what's going on in food, and have an amazing group of people, my staff, follow me because I do focus really strongly on being better tomorrow and figuring out what the next thing is we should be doing, and more importantly, helping my team grow with me.
Now, you were very sensitive to ambience and situation. I was blown away because most people weren't paying any attention to any of that.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's a sort of a given now that you have restaurants designed. But back in those days, we really looked at, and I suppose it comes from being front of house and then back of house and understanding what makes a restaurant tick, I suppose. I was very focused on the fact that a restaurant is a group of experiences. You know, the whole sum of its parts makes it stronger. So realizing that it wasn't just me cooking food then, it wasn't us just choosing the best wines, it wasn't us training a team of people that could serve and look after and explain what we were trying to do and make life a joy. But it was really important that we created that in an environment that added weight to all of those things. So ambience was just as important, design was just as important. And I think it comes back to my decision very early on, sort of the mid-80s, that we weren't really in the restaurant business, that we were actually in the business of creating memories, and that we were, in essence, I suppose, yes, we have a physical restaurant and we're cooking food and we're serving it, we're pouring wine. But every single day we're there to create a new memory. And if we create a great memory, people will talk about us, people will think about that, want to come back. And that's the why we do what we do. And as long as we sort of do that, we emotionally connect with people.
Now, you've explored a number of different concepts. I mean, originally, you were Seafood, were we? And, but you've, of course, here we are in Melbourne, and it was fabulous meat, you know. But a lot of especially Australian restaurateurs and chefs want to branch out to New York or London. You never did that.
Well, watch this space. I haven't done that yet, but I've just recently had a merger of two businesses that I'm involved in, and the bigger company, which is now called Rockpool Dining Group, that I'm a shareholder in. One of our focuses is to grow. We believe we have the best restaurant dining group in Australia, but it is really to grow outside of that and to be recognised as having globally one of the great restaurant groups. And what's fantastic is we have everything from what we call premium pillars to our business, right through to fast casuals with Burger Project. And we don't have to move away from any of the DNA that drives the premium part of the business. Even at, say, Burger Project, my burger place, we still work on sustainability, we still work on waste and composting, we still work on Cape Grim beef, we still hand make the patties in each individual store. We work with community, and importantly, we work with young, great young people in Australia to, you know, take them off welfare, to put them into jobs. We've got a very community-minded focus. So our entire business is really built on sustainability and, most importantly, about, you know, care and empathy.
Interestingly, in a few days, we're going to a place called Charcoal Lane, which maybe you even know, because it seems their mission is to do some of the things you just described. But I wanted to ask you a different question before I surrender the microphone again. Do you know Danny Meyer?
I do.
Okay. And you're not doing anything like what he's been trying to do, I suppose. But maybe the Burger Project will go public at $500 million, and then you'll be so rich you'll be able to put your feet up finally for the last time. But it's really so funny that you mentioned what you did about your team, because if you've read Danny's book, he asks the question, who are the most important people in the success of a restaurant? And the answer isn't the customers. The answer is the staff, he said, because if the staff is happy and having a good time, then everything will work.
Yes.
And it's really funny. You probably know our good friends Gail and Kevin Donovan. We were at their restaurant just the other day, and I noticed something. I said, Kevin, I said, everybody in your whole restaurant is laughing. The people in the kitchen are laughing. The people in the front of house are laughing because they're all having a good time. Is that part of what you're trying to do?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, going back to Danny Meyer, I think if you looked at our parallel careers, you would see two people, one in America and one in Australia, that truly believe in hospitality and generosity. And we see a lot of mirrored things in what Danny's been achieving and what I've attempted to achieve. And one of the things that is really important to me is the empathy of the business, the care of the business. And we talk a lot about, obviously, our suppliers, but we talk about the place that we live in, the earth that we're walking on, and the amount of energy we have to make sure that we're leaving that in better shape if we possibly can for future generations. And we have to work very hard on our people, which is one of our big focuses. Our staff are key to everything that we can achieve in the future. And, you know, lastly, it's interesting because we talk about profit and profitability, but it's so important because without that profitable, sustainable, stable business, one can't talk about looking after their people, sustainability, buying the greatest ingredients. It's quite interesting because in 2008, I think, you know, Obama had come to the White House and all the world leaders were at a consensus on climate change, and they're about to sign an agreement going forward on delivering future generations a better and cleaner planet. And the financial crisis hit the world, and everyone's first reaction in government was, oh, we can only talk about jobs and saving financial institutions. We can't save the planet anymore because we can't afford it. And I think that's a really great lesson in life, that we take our eye off what are the most important things, and we don't have a good, strong business, sound business structure to build that on, it's very, very different. And going back to Danny and Burger Project and of course, Shake Shack, one of the things that inspired me about Shake Shack and Smashburger and Australia, I suppose, Huckster Burger and a few other places, was I looked at my business partner, Trish, and I said, do you know, people are willing to pay enough for a hamburger now that we could actually take all the DNA of Rockpool Bar and Grill and create Burger Project, and we wouldn't have to take a backward step on quality of ingredient, levels of service, the young people that we inspire, or community or sustainability. And she said, well, let's do it. And that was the history, really, of us getting into the hamburger business.
Now, just go through for us, if you will, a roll call. You mentioned a couple of places, but there's an Italian-themed restaurant that's sort of right next door. Yeah. There's a one called Spice Temple, which is clearly somewhat different. So for those who never heard of Neil Perry but would like to take advantage of knowing you as you do now, where can they go? What are the themes and what are the places?
Yeah, well, I mean, what we have is, three pillars. We talk about our business in now. The Rockpool Dining Group is premium, fun casual, and fast casual. So in premium, which are attempts to do the best possible restaurants we can in the cuisines that we work in, Rockpool Bar and Grill, we believe, is one of the great steakhouses in the world. We believe that Rosetta is one of the great Italian fine dining restaurants, and that Spice Temple is a wonderful regional Chinese restaurant, not focusing on Cantonese food, but focusing on Sichuan, Hunan, Xinjiang, etc., and obviously by the name, quite spicy. And then we have Sake, which is our Japanese contemporary Japanese restaurant that we believe is fantastic because we put the same layer of sourcing ingredients that we do at Bar and Grill and so forth over sake now, and we think that you know, the best fish are coming in the back door, the most beautiful organic chickens, the most fantastic organic pork, Cape Grim, David Blackmore. So it's perfect for that gorgeous Japanese seasoning, and Japanese food is really about seasonality and quality of ingredient. And then in the fun casuals, we have Fratelli Fresh, which is a lovely, simple, you know, pasta and pizza place. We have the Bavarians, which are a beautiful kind of craft beer you know, a view back to those kind of Munich beer halls, I suppose, and that we consider those our kind of pubs and young people having fun and drinking and eating and being convivial, really. And then in the in the fast casual, we have Saki Junior, which is our kind of pokey restaurant where we do ramen and Japanese fried chicken, but we mainly do build your own bowl kind of pokey with sustainable tuna, and it's got responsible sourcing you know, at its base. Burger Project, which again is really all about, we say to our kids, you're building the best burger in the world, and if they ever say, well, how can you say that, we say, well, we're taking 36 month Cape Grim beef out of northwestern Tasmania, cleanest rainwater on earth. It's coming to us as whole muscle meat. We're cutting it, we're mincing it, and we're hand forming it into a patty in every single store. So we have complete control over the cold chain management. You know, our soft serves are made from milk, cream, vanilla, real vanilla bean, real Valrhona chocolate. So we're really just focusing on the very simple things in life, but we make the pickles, we make the relish, roast the beetroot, we confit the mushrooms. If you go there and have a burger, you eat one of the great burgers in the world.
Now, after lunch today, you selected the menu for us. I said, you know, I'd be very happy not to eat again until I leave Australia, because I don't want to muddy the waters of my flavor memories of this one. Did you train as a chef? I mean, I don't know how you make everything so delicious.
Well, interestingly, I didn't do any culinary school or anything like that. So I was front of house, decided I really wanted to cook. I guess I always knew I wanted to, but I finally had the courage and impetus and savings, which was important because I had to go back and not earn very much money for a very long time. Well, not a very long time, 12 months. And then I went and worked with some of the great people around Australia. But I think because I had been working in wine, in the wine industry, and buying wine and tasting wine, because my father had taught me about how to taste food, because he'd always say to me, so what does that taste like? So, you know, what does that fish taste like? Does that taste really fresh to you? What does that tomato that we've just picked off the vine taste like? So Dad got me to understand, I suppose, flavor memory and being able to draw on things that I'd tasted and how that related to things that I was tasting in the future. And so my whole life I've kind of really been grown to be a chef without realizing it. I started work at Barrenjoey House with my own kitchen and wrote the menu, and that was a fantastic time. But in 84 I went to France and went around and travelled and ate in some of the great restaurants in France, Robuchon and La Castrade and Pic and Georges Blanc and Bacchus and Alain, he's no longer there, he passed away when he was about 50, Trois Gros. And went to Chrissier and went to Freddie Gerardet, which was absolutely fantastic. I'm so happy I got to eat Gerardet's food and talk to him in my life. And I came back and I was at a restaurant called Barrenjoey House in Palm Beach, which is the most beautiful place in Australia. It's kind of a beautiful river and bay on one side of the peninsula, on the other it's surf. And I was cooking, essentially, I suppose, French provincial food. And I came back with a very naive idea, really. It was so obvious. But I went, I've just eaten the most incredible French food in France. These guys are cooking beautifully. But it makes so much sense. They're in France, so why wouldn't they be cooking French food? What am I doing sitting in Palm Beach cooking French food in Australia? And so then I made the conscious decision to think about what have I loved eating all my life? What have I loved eating in Australia? What cuisines do I really enjoy, many of which are Asian? And so then I decided to make sure that my food had, you know, Middle Eastern influences, Chinese influences, Indian influences, Thai influences, Japanese influence, because that's the food that actually excited me. And that's the food that, because of our multicultural nature in Australia, was really part of the Australian fabric in any case. And I suppose that's when people started to talk about people like Philip Searle and Chong Liu and myself kind of creating, I suppose, you know, what we call modern Australian food now.
I'm still not sure, as you know. I mean, when I was here, the offerings are like mainly British hotel food. How did you actually develop the audience of people who really knew what taste they wanted and could appreciate what you were doing?
Well, I think it's really an interesting question, because I think you end up being as good as your audience will allow you to be. And I think Australia in the 80s and 90s, and even Australia now, for instance, are incredibly adventurous people. And we look to the next thing. We eat a lot of really fantastic, authentic, ethnic food because of our multiculturalism. We grow incredible ingredients, everything from, you know, English spinach to kachai for you know, Thai cooking, so that we have an amazing array of ingredients. We have, I think, some of the best seafood in the world. The Australian public kind of demand, we want a great coffee. Where are we going to get that? We're interested in who's baking the best bread. And they were really fantastic in that sort of 80s, 90s, and even now, at saying, we want to eat interesting, exciting food. So we're going to sit at the table, and we're not going to change anything. We want you to give us what you are feeling and thinking at the moment, and then we'll tell you whether we like it or not. We'll either come or we won't come, and if we come, you can stay in business and what you're doing must be good, and if we don't come, then you're in some serious trouble. But there was no thought to trying to change you or mold you into something that they wanted. There was a genuine feeling at that fine dining level of excitement and what was the next taste and flavor that they were going to experience.
Well, I think this year is a major step forward, because one of the things is from, how to phrase this, I mean, Australia is kind of out there to most of the world that we, well, for the Western world, for example, or the Latin American world. But this event of having the world's 50 best restaurants awards here, and was it 25 years for the Food and Wine Festival in Melbourne. This has to be a game changer.
Yeah, look, absolutely. I mean, I think Australia's got a lot to spruik, not just in food and wine and people and sunshine, but we have an amazing country that is so beautiful to see, and I'd impress upon people to get out of the country. Sorry, get out of the city and get into the country. And I only see the beautiful, like, not incredible places like, you know, Yarra Valley or Mornington Peninsula, which is so close to Melbourne. But to go to the centre of Australia, or go to Katherine, or go to Olga's, or go to The Rock, or go to Broome, or go to The Brief. Australia's a very ancient land, so an opportunity to see how incredible it is. The red earth is as beautiful as the lush green often. But I think this is really fantastic in terms of bringing people to Australia continually, It started with invite people to Australia with Restaurant Australia when we did the dinner in Tasmania.
Yeah, right.
It continued with Noma. It's continuing now with Top 50. Australian tourism has a very strong focus on the fact that people who haven't come to Australia don't realise how sophisticated, how delicious and how amazing the country is to see. So we're trying to communicate that, and Top 50 is a really important part of that. And I was just saying to some guys I was talking to earlier today that what's really interesting is chefs have an amazing ability to care about the planet, each other, and various things that really shouldn't be our responsibility, but seem to be, which is amazing.
And they summarize experiences.
Ask him how good his fat rice is. Then you'll know if he's any good or not.
Yeah.
We just interviewed a couple from Chicago. They have a restaurant in Chicago called Fat Rice.
Oh, right, okay.
But their inspiration is the dish that is the national dish of Macau.
Called
fat rice. So if he looks puzzled when it's fat rice, or she looks puzzled when it's fat rice, don't hire him.
Last
evening, curiously enough, we met one of your sommelier team. His name is Amy.
Yes.
She was sitting eating at another restaurant at a table right next to us, and Manuela Pignotti took great care of us today. I mention their names only because they're part of a wine team.
Yes.
That really knows what's going on. I'm not even going to go over the wines they selected from us, except to say they were all quite brilliant.
Yeah.
I have one final question, because we have a few days left in Melbourne, and we already enjoyed Neil Perry in Melbourne, but we're going to be in Sydney, and we have one meal slot to spare. Where should we go?
Okay, so if it's not one of my restaurants, then there's a young guy cooking at a little place just on the fringe of the city called Esther, Matt Lindsay, and he's cooking some really fantastic food. So I would say you go to Esther when you're in Sydney, or Bar and Grill, Spice Temple, Saki, or 11 Bridge are all great restaurants of mine. But yeah, probably Esther, and the other one is Bridge Room. Those two, to me, are two really fantastic restaurants in Sydney.
Well, somehow or other, with this simple-minded effort that I have, we're going to one of those.
Oh, fantastic.
Called the Bridge Room.
Yeah.
We're excited for Wednesday night.
Absolutely.
We hope your country scores well. We think it should. And it's been a delight to meet you again and have a chance to talk to you. And as a final thought, I'm sure.
No, except that I'm elated at the idea that we go on and we go on. And to run into somebody that we've known for such a long time and to find out that he's just getting more remarkable by the minute. Let's just cheers for us. What do we call us? Endurers.
Yeah, thank you very much. Just keep on keeping on. So, I'm looking forward to another 20 years if I possibly can, because I love the business so much. So thank you very much.
So there you are. Another week, another opening, another show. As they say in the theatre business, we are happy to have brought you yet another program from Australia, yet another program in the On the Menu series, now in its 14th year or 15th year. How many years
14.
Is it? 14th year. So we hope you'll join us again.
It's
same
about 13
time.
13 and a half.
Yeah, okay. So we hope you'll join us again, same time, same place. And until then,
bye-bye.